Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo issued subpoenas today to find out who's getting that $165 million in bonuses at AIG. Yesterday, the insurance giant refused to voluntarily hand over that information, despite general outrage from the White House on down that the bonuses came out of the $170 billion taxpayer bailout and are going primarily to the AIG unit responsible for making the risky investments that brought that company down. Meanwhile, going forward, other Wall Street firms that took government bailout money are reportedly looking for ways to skirt new caps on compensation, caps that went into effect after AIG got its bailout. David Enrich of the Wall Street Journal joins us. Remind us why these banks are facing restrictions.
They're facing restrictions on this because of a provision that was added into the economic stimulus bill last month that basically sought to impose much tighter reins on the bonuses that these banks can pay out. And bonuses usually make up the vast majority of compensations. And there's a lot of unanswered questions. The wording of the bill was fairly vague, and a lot of these banks, ranging from giants like Citigroup and Morgan Stanley and Goldman right on down, are really hoping that the Treasury Department, which is in the process of kind of coming up with guidance for the banks on how to interpret these rules, they're really hoping that it gets watered down in that process.
Well, in the meantime, you alluded to the salary structure. Remind us how it works, because you write that most traders and bankers on Wall Street get a base salary. It's from $200,000 for managing directors to $1.5 million for CEOs, and then they get these bonuses. So what are Wall Street firms looking to do to get around the caps?
They're going to dramatically increase, in a lot of cases, I think, the base salaries that these people are paying. And some of the banks are saying that they're considering increasing salaries that right now are in the $500,000 range, maybe increasing it to $3 or $4 million, just because that would allow them to essentially avoid these new restrictions on bonuses.
Well, why would they start with the high salaries in the first place? Why are they even bothering with the bonuses? What's the benefit?
Because the whole mantra on Wall Street is pay for performance. And the notion is that if you produce a lot of revenue for your firm, you should get compensated accordingly. The problem often is that people get paid for short-term performance. If those bets go bad in the longer run, the people don't have to return the money. But in this case, I mean, increasing base salaries by a factor of 2 or 3 or 5 or 6 means that people are getting that money no matter what. It's much less of a performance-based pay system.
Well, it sounds as if, you know, what was once a bonus now is just an expected salary.
Certainly is right. That was a huge problem. Distorted incentives, and it caused people to take enormous risks just for a short-term profit.
To get the money that they expected to get because it was viewed by them as their salary. Well, you know, and we hear, too, that one of the reasons that AIG and other companies are saying we have to pay either these bonuses or now, as we're, you know, perhaps going to hear, these high salaries, because otherwise we'll lose these people. But the joke is, of course, how good could they be if they got you into this problem? But also, where would they go? Isn't the whole industry shrinking?
Yeah, the whole industry is shrinking, and I think there's a lot of truth to that point, that the leverage that employees once held over their employers about, well, I'm going to go jump to a rival bank, holds a little less water today. That said, there are still, a lot of hedge funds out there that are looking for talented employees, and there are a lot of banks, especially banks outside of the U.S. that have big U.S. operations, like in German and Swiss banks, French banks, Spanish banks, that aren't subject to the same restrictions on pay because they didn't receive federal taxpayer money. And so there is a concern, which I think is slightly, I think the Wall Streeters tend to exaggerate this concern because they obviously want to operate in an unfettered manner. But I think there is at least a kernel of truth.
Well, quick question. So you say other banks are looking to skirt both the new caps, but also maybe some of the outrage about the word bonuses and these extra. Isn't there going to be outrage at these huge increased salaries? And is there anything that Washington might say about that?
Yeah, I think there's a pretty good chance that's going to encounter considerable criticism. I think the banks are pretty cognizant of that at this point, after having been embarrassed by flying around in corporate jets and having expensive corporate retreats and things like that. The banks are pretty sensitive to it. Citigroup, for instance, is aware of this and have no intention of being the first bank to go down this road and test these new limits.
On the other hand, David, as you've explained this, there are conceivably some workers who are now $200,000 is a lot of money.
Yep.
To most Americans, but on Wall Street it's not. And since the structure was such that the bonuses were literally the salary, you know, we've heard some of these bonuses are, you know, maybe $1,000. Aren't there going to be some workers who are really going to be cheated out of their salary if these bonuses aren't allowed?
There are plenty of people on Wall Street in various capacities who are getting unfairly maligned because of the reputation the industry has right now. And they didn't do anything wrong. They didn't cause this mess. And this is on individual basis at people at these big companies. But people are in these professions. It's high reward professions. They get paid extraordinarily well. And with that high compensation comes high risks. I don't have an immense amount of sympathy for the people who have been making a ton of money and now are going to face less bonuses.
David Enrich of The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, there's a lot of anger about the AIG bonuses, but how far will it go? Our next guest uses pushpins on a world map to track global economic protests and riots from China to Dublin. It's become a very crowded map, and Michael Clare, a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College here in Massachusetts, warns in a recent edition of the online journal TomDispatch.com that more unrest may erupt, and it may erupt here in the U.S. Michael Clare joins us from the studios of WFCR in Amherst, Mass. And Michael, you describe a revolt in Longnam, China, where the factory workers said they'd been mistreated, and then they just trashed the factory. So stay with China. What's the economic trigger there?
Well, of course, China's economy is heavily dependent on exports to the United States. And with the economic downturn in the USA, we're buying less Chinese products. And so a lot of factories in China have lost all their orders. And often in the middle of the night, the factory will shut down. The workers will show up the next morning. The factory is closed. They haven't been paid in a week or weeks. And the workers will spontaneously erupt in protest. And with the number of workers in China that are unemployed now said to exceed 20 million, you can imagine that Chinese authorities are deeply alarmed by this situation.
Give us some other examples. Hopscotch around the globe.
Well, the first one of the protests that caught public attention was Athens, Greece. This was in December, when the police shot and killed a 15-year-old boy.
And what does that have to do with the economy? Because that was terrible, but we understood that people, especially young people, were reacting to the fact that a 15-year-old had been shot. What does it have to do with the economy?
Somehow this provoked a spark of rampage and frustration among the young people of Athens, because for the next 6 days, the city was essentially shut down by thousands, tens of thousands of young people, college students and unemployed youth who rampaged through the city, burning department stores, luxury hotels. And when asked what brought out this massive uproar of anger and rage, they said that they saw no future for them in this society. There was no prospect of employment. They were going to school, learning skills for which there were no jobs, and they basically were expressing frustration with the government, with their education, and basically a lack of hope in the future. That then was followed by similar protests in Vilnius, in Riga, and Sofia throughout Eastern Europe, and the message is always the same. We have no faith in public institutions, in corporations. We have no hope that the market is going to provide us with a future. And so there's this deep sense that the future is getting worse, not better.
Well, and to round out our look around the world, last spring we saw riots in response to rising food costs in Haiti. People stormed the presidential palace demanding food. There were protests in Egypt, Ethiopia, Indonesia. And you say that between severe droughts and the cost of oil, there's a perfect recipe here for unrest.
Yes, indeed. Now, the cost of food has dropped a bit because the price of oil has gone down, and food prices are very heavily tied to oil prices. But now we have an increased level of drought in the world, so I fear that food prices are going to rise again in the future, just at a time when many people in the developing world are going to see a decline in their standard of living because of the economic crisis. So we could see a much greater incidence of food despair and food violence in the years ahead.
Well, in February, CIA Director Leon Panetta gave President Obama the first Economic Intelligence White House briefing. And on that same day, National Intelligence Director Dennis Blair told Congress that the economic crisis has replaced terrorism as the number one security threat to the U.S.
Dennis Blair, the Director of National Intelligence, said that time is the critical factor. He said the longer that the economic crisis prevails, the greater the likelihood that this will lead to massive civil disorder and violent extremism. And he compared the current period to the 1930s, and he said, we all remember what happened in Europe in the 1930s, the rise of violent extremism at that time in Europe, and we have to be on guard that we don't see similar manifestations of extremism in this period if the crisis persists more than a year or two.
I can hear Americans listening to this and saying, yes, but that's there. That could never happen here.
Well, you know, if you look back to the 1930s, at first it was the same here as well. But as the Great Depression went on, that changed. You had an increase in strikes if conditions continued to deteriorate. I can't imagine that people wouldn't start expressing their frustration and rage.
Michael Clare, if you had to make a prediction, we began by talking about those red pushpins that you could put in place where there's been rioting around the world. Where would you put it here?
I would be looking at the Rust Belt states. But maybe people there are already in such deep shock and despair that they're not capable of protests.
But isn't one of the problems in the U.S. is that protests against who? I mean, you know, we have an administration that has said that trying to right the economy is priority number one. What are the signs going to say? Who are they going after?
Fair enough. I mean, you're going to have more massive layoffs from big corporations. That could be the trigger. But also foreclosures are going to continue to increase. And one of the things you had in the Depression, and I'm beginning to hear anecdotal stories about this, is during the Depression, people would rally neighbors to prevent the sheriff from coming to carry out people's belonging into the streets.
So perhaps the form of protest may take those forms.
Exactly. And you've already had the famous case in Chicago of the window manufacturer where people occupied their factory and held it until there was a promise of keeping it open. We could see more activities of that sort.
That's Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. We'll link you to his article, A Planet at the Brink. Will economic brush fires prove too virulent to contain? We'll have that at our website, herenow.org. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Well, and just ahead, we'll meet a conservative sheriff in Ohio who's making his own sort of one-man protest. He said he will not evict people who have nowhere to go. So a foreclosure protest there in Ohio. Also later today, newspapers moving online. Will it work? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the global economic crisis, public anger, and the possibility that increased unemployment and more foreclosures could result in, well, maybe even protest. We have seen housing activists like Acorn protesting at the homes of bank CEOs to stop foreclosures. And now along comes Sheriff Richard K. Jones of Butler County in Ohio. As sheriff, he steps in once a person is evicted due to foreclosure. And Sheriff Jones, explain, first of all, what you have to do when a property is foreclosed.
Basically, in Ohio, the sheriff is responsible for sheriff sales, foreclosures, and sells the houses at auctions. And then out of that, in Butler County, it's 350,000 population. And out of that, there's 2,000 sheriff sales today. And of that 2,000, 500 forced evictions. Of the forced evictions, probably 56 actually get forced out. The others move out. That's where the sheriff has to set their belongings, on the step, out on the sidewalk. And the people have to be taken out of their house, the doors, the locks changed, and it's gotten worse. And I've told people that it's not like that we live in Hawaii here in Ohio. We have severe winters. And I told them basically I wasn't going to give somebody the death penalty and put them out on the sidewalk and cause their death.
So what is your stand on evictions? What have you told your deputies to do when I'm presuming it's the bank that comes to you and says...
Oh, it's the banks, and it's a court order from the court. Mm-hmm. And if I disobey a court order, I myself will go to jail.
So what have you told your people to do?
Well, here's what I've told my people to do. Find shelter for these people. If we can't find shelter, go back to the courts. The courts have been working with us. We've had a couple, three instances where we almost had nowhere for these people to go. We had an elderly gentleman that didn't have any family. He had some mental issues, and we found a shelter at the last minute that he could go to. Now, let me tell you something else. Some of these people, you got to realize, they pay rent, and some of the landlords aren't making the payments. The people that are renters have no idea that the payment's not being made on their house or their apartment.
Well, Sheriff Jones, let's set the scene here a little bit. First of all, how would you characterize yourself? Would you say you're pretty much a law and order guy?
Oh, very law and order, very conservative. My last election, I won by 73% of the vote.
Yeah. So are you prepared? I mean, you, at the last minute, found shelters for these three families that you had a court order to evict. But if the next time you don't, are you prepared to turn to the court and say, I will not evict people?
Well, it's not come to that yet. I'm not going to go to jail. I wouldn't do well in jail. Now, the landlords, they weren't too excited about it in the beginning. I'm still serving evictions, but I'm just trying to find shelter for these people. And if I draw attention and I get right to that border where I may have to go to jail, I'm not going to refuse a court order. The courts are working with me.
You know, how does it feel for you to know? Now, you're meeting these people. You're in the front lines. You know, you're seeing this elderly man with mental issues. How would it feel to just put them on the street?
You can't explain how it feels. The persons that I have that do that, the deputy sat in my office, the female deputy, young lady, and she was so distraught and upset. The week after that or 2 weeks after that, it was a person with family that had kids. And the shelters don't always take families with kids. They'll take individuals. The shelters are full in the wintertime here. And that's not my job to try to find shelter for these people. But I'm a human being first, and these people haven't done anything wrong other than, you know, we don't have debtors' prisons in the United States anymore. We've got to do something. The President of the United States has to do something to stop this epidemic. I'm not the only sheriff in the country. There was a sheriff in Cook County, Illinois, I think it was, that had the same dilemma. We're standing up because we're the ones that have to put these people out on the street.
Well, what are the other concerns of a sheriff in particular? Obviously, you have these emotional human concerns you're speaking of, but what are other concerns when people are evicted and maybe living in cars? We're hearing about the new tent city, 400, 500 people living outside Sacramento, empty homes with, you know, drug dealers moving in. What are some of the other concerns of a sheriff?
Well, here's the concerns is, I've been told these people are leaving their homes. They have nowhere to take their pets. We're going into homes where cats and dogs have been in these homes for days and days with no water, no food. They're just leaving their pets, or they're leaving them chained up outside. They go to their cars. They're trying to stay warm. They could freeze to death in their cars. A lot of these people are people that's never been homeless before, and this is new to them.
What would you like to see happen? Should there be a moratorium on foreclosures? Should the president just order that rather than houses sit empty, banks just let people live where they are until the money starts to flow through? What would you suggest?
Well, the President of the United States has inherited this. They've got to sit down. This stimulus stuff that they're doing, that's not helping the direct people that are out there right now. There's got to be something done from the top person, and the President of the United States, doesn't matter if he inherited or not, he's the commander-in-chief. He has to get people together because this is not getting better. This is getting worse as we speak. We're still doing sheriff sales. We're still doing foreclosures. The homeless shelters are out of control. They're filled up to the max in the wintertime. I mean, and it's getting worse. It wouldn't take much to tip it over a little bit.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, it wouldn't take much to where they wonder if there is no place. And these people get to the street and they start dying. Believe me, there's either been people die or people are going to die because they have nowhere to go. And these are people that aren't used to being out in the elements. and it's dangerous out there.
Well, Sheriff Jones, you know, I'm just thinking that this isn't the most important facet of our conversation, but it's striking me that here you are, a self-described, very conservative, we know, Republican, the area that you're in, suddenly finding yourself strange bedfellows with tenants' rights organizations like Acorn, who are protesting the banks, asking them to work with people in trouble rather than evict them.
Yeah, that puts me in a strange boat, doesn't it? Who would have thought 2 years ago? And when you look at my website or my blog, you'll see how conservative I am. If you Google my name, it's like 1.2 million. I've been in newspapers all over the world and for other conservative issues, and I'm just a sheriff. But and then all of a sudden, myself and Acorn are on this same page. It's hey, only in America.
Sheriff Jones, thanks very much, and best of luck to you there.
Hey, good luck. Say a prayer for us.
Okay. Richard Jones, sheriff of Butler County in Ohio. We'll link you to his blog at our website, herenow.org. Okay, later today, Mystery Science Theater returns, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Let's check in Iraq. Iraqis are much more hopeful about the future and increasingly preoccupied with more conventional concerns like how to eat meals in the dark. That's the main finding in a new poll done for the BBC and ABC, and it represents a striking shift since the last poll in March 2008. You can read the poll at our website, herenow.org. But to put a personal face on the numbers, the BBC's Hugh Sykes checked in on Iraqi family he met last March to find out how life is going for them now, especially for their son, a young musician.
March 2008. The Baghdad School of Music and Dance.
Two, three, four.
A trio is rehearsing Haydn, the Toy Symphony, or the Children's Symphony, as Haydn called it in German. In a neighbouring room, Farhan Nashat, nearly 14 years old, was practising his trumpet. He told me a bit about his life in Baghdad.
We stay in the house doing nothing. So all I do is just playing on the computer or my instrument, watch TV or do my homeworks. That's it. I want to play football, a lot of football. Because since I've been a child, when the Iraq has been invasions, I didn't play ball outside ever. Ever.
Now, Farhan is nearly 15, and he is playing football.
I play a lot in the school.
Have you scored goals?
Yeah, three or four.
Do you feel safer than you felt when we met a year ago?
Yes, it's a lot of safe here now, because of the National Guards and the checkpoints. So it's safe here.
Farhan's mother, Bushra, has prepared the BBC visitors a sumptuous, generous meal.
It's very simple. Pizza. Lahma ba'ajin.
Lahma ba'ajin, what's that mean?
Meatloaf.
Meatloaf pizza.
And this is biryani.
And underneath the bread over there, what's that?
Kebab.
Oh, kebab, biryani, salad. What a fantastic spread.
Hey.
Bushra's name translates as good news. How is it here now?
It's good, very good. The street is more safe. It's good now.
But then she qualifies her judgment after years of murder, explosions, kidnapping, sectarian violence, and a vicious insurgency. Better and good in Iraq are relative.
It's much better because it's, in the past it's zero. Before it was very bad. And now it's improved to 30 or 25%. So it's not very good, not good enough.
Getting better, but from a very bad position.
Yeah, much better than zero.
How is the electricity supply?
It's very bad.
There's no electricity here at home now.
I wash clothes with my hand without electricity, so it's very difficult.
Ah! The lights have just come on. They must have been listening to us. And you can hear the fridge. The hum of the fridge.
Yes.
So you avoid opening it in hot weather.
Yeah, we can't keep the food and we don't have cold water to drink.
And you need cold water here in the summer because sometimes the temperature is 40, 50 degrees.
Yes.
So life here is still very unpredictable.
Yeah.
And the Americans are on their way slowly to leave Iraq. Are you comfortable that the Americans leave and hand over security to the Iraqis?
No. I don't feel comfortable if Americans leave because I feel they make the situation more safe.
The Americans make it safer here?
Yeah. I think that.
Do you have confidence in the government, in the Prime Minister? She answers that with an uncertain swivel of one hand. Half and half, 50-50.
I believe in God. If something want to happen, it happens. Maybe terrorists, maybe destiny, you know, anything.
You may have heard the 146-year-old Seattle Post-Intelligencer publishes its final print edition today and will then shift its operation to the web. Well, Denver's Rocky Mountain News closed down entirely last month, and some of its former staffers are also going to try to transition to the web without the structure of the old paper behind them. They're counting on the paper's 200,000-plus readers to chip in. Here's a clip from a YouTube video produced by the group.
Hi, I'm Aaron Lopez. I was a sports writer with the Rocky Mountain News. When the paper closed, I felt like a victim of identity theft. Now you can help me get that identity back by supporting our new website. And I can go back to giving you the coverage of all the Denver sports that you love, just as I have for the past 15 years.
Melissa Bomponio worked as an editor at the Rocky Mountain News for 9 years, was chair of the paper's guild, and now is helping to spearhead that online effort in DenverTimes.com. Melissa, you and colleagues founded a smaller online service, IWantMyRocky.com, to keep the paper alive. But even after the paper failed, you keep at this. Why?
I think, you know, when the Rocky Mountain News closed, many of our reporters spoke up and said, look, I've got this great story that's going to break on Monday or Tuesday, and we want to find a place to put them. And I said, put them on I Want My Rocky. So it's definitely a grassroots kind of thing on that particular website. And then, you know, the idea of actually doing this on a larger scale grew from there.
Well, and it would seem to be a daunting one. I mean, you're doing it without all the structure that, for instance, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer brings from its newspaper to the web. You're just the reporters. And we know that you have three founding investors who are behind you. But tell us a little bit more about the plan. How many subscribers do you need to do what you want to do, and what's your deadline?
We're hoping to get 50,000 people willing to pay for a subscription, $4.99 a month, by April 23rd. A big chunk of our news will be free and accessible to anybody. And then our premium content, our columnist voices, our cartoons, our multimedia, the interaction with our writers would come with that subscription.
Melissa, I want to ask you about another aspect, because we've talked about this in our office, and we talk about how there's blogs and there's all of this stuff online. But the fact is, it would seem that most of what's blogged about is taken from newspapers. Do you guys find yourself thinking, well, wait a second, we're the beat reporters, we're the ones who went on the street, we're the ones who enterprised the stories, you know, found stories that then get rehashed by other services that aren't news services? And if this continues, we're sort of cannibalizing the source of news.
You're absolutely right. When people take such glee in certain newspapers folding because they're, you know, conservative or liberal, or that we don't carry your favorite comics or whatever, that's a sad statement to me, because we are professionals. We are out there, you know, watching your elected officials and reporting on what's going on behind the city hall doors and that kind of thing. And yes, the bloggers are picking that stuff up, rehashing it, and then throwing it back out there as, you know, some sort of, quote, news thing. And it's frustrating, and we're hoping that people are willing to pay a little bit to subscribe to what we're going to do professionally. And we're committed now to putting our voice back out there. But I feel like the community, through talking back to us through IWantMyRocky.com, you know, told us that this was something that they wanted. that they wanted to support us in any way they could so that they could get back their Rocky. And that's what people in Denver call the Rocky Mountain News, My Rocky. Yeah. So there's a sense of ownership from the community with all the writers at our newspaper.
Melissa Pomponio, formerly of the Rocky Mountain News, now with a new effort to move part of that paper, at least online, indenvertimes.com. Melissa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Mark Jerkowitz, a longtime journalist and media critic, now an associate director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. This week they released their 2009 report on the state of the news media. And Mark, first of all, just do you agree with that last point we were making, that when papers fail, we lose sort of a front line in reporting that's become a huge resource for a lot of online civilian blogging?
Well, that it's not only a huge resource for online civilian blogging, but it's a huge resource for television news, for radio news. I mean, the problem for people who really worry about the current state of journalism, at this point, the issue isn't so much, you know, do we preserve the print newspaper or the online version? The question is, can we find a business model that will subsidize the newsroom that used to exist, the kind of newsroom that traditionally was in a newspaper building that provided the investigative journalism, that provided the foreign bureaus, that provided the specialties in health and science, that allowed journalists to take 2 or 3 months to write series. And that's what, I mean, we'll have plenty of information out there, no matter what happens and how much this world fragments. The question is, what will the quality of that information be? And that's exactly right.
Right, the foot soldiers may be gone. Well, how practical is this move to online in preserving that journalism? The Rocky writers considered a nonprofit mold, but then these three investors approached them, and these investors are confident that with subscribers they can pay the 30 or so, there's reporters, editors, and one cartoonist for the Rocky Online
sure.
project. How realistic is this?
Well, in any given local community, depending on how much passion there is for the organization, you might be able to make a go of this, you know, a subscription-based, you know, fairly small-scale project. But as a broader example, the idea of getting consumers to pay for content has failed, and has been one of the reasons why the biggest problem with newspaper journalism today, in some ways, is that the online revenue model is failing. They talked about walling off some of their premium content and getting subscribers to pay for it. They may be able to do that in Denver. Let's not forget that in some ways the most prestigious brand name in American newspapering, the New York Times, tried that a couple years ago with something called Time Select, and it failed, and they had to stop. And there is a, you know, one of the debates that's now going on, it's a little after the fact in journalism, is, geez, how come we never made anybody pay for our content? And so Walter Isaacson, for example, just wrote a piece recently in Time Magazine, talked about micropayments. Couldn't we get people to sort of almost like, you know, the little easy passes that you have on the toll booth, you know, pay a little bit for, you know, newspaper content incrementally, and won't that work? And frankly, of all the things that the newspaper industry and the journalism industry needs to try, the one that just doesn't seem to fly on any kind of a consistent, broadly applied basis is getting consumers to pay for news.
Well, that doesn't bode well for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. We see they're going to be exclusively an online news source starting today. And the Seattle PI is the largest major daily to make that leap, but they leave behind the Seattle Times in Seattle. It's the only standing paper there, but that paper's also struggling financially. Is it possible we're going to very soon see a city with no paper?
Well, that could be the case. It wouldn't be a shock if we saw a significant major city without a paper. There was just I know some of this resonated up in Boston. There was just a list of papers that was published by, I believe, a blogger who sort of had his endangered species list of newspapers around the country.
I think it might have been Time Magazine, even. You know, more than a blogger. Yeah.
But I think it was a blog originally from the Wall Street Journal. I could be wrong.
Right.
But anyway, you know,
the Boston Globe was on it.
Yeah, the Boston Globe was now the Boston. If the Boston Globe was on it, do we expect that the Boston Herald, a much smaller newspaper that's had financial problems for a long time, would survive? The answer is probably not. And one of the reasons, frankly, Robin, that we don't see more print newspapers simply going online, where obviously the costs are a lot less expensive, you don't have distribution, you don't have presses, is because even as bad as things are,
90% of revenue from the news organization comes from the ads in the print product.
That's Mark Jerkowitz of the Pew Center for Excellence in Journalism. Mark, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
Okay, we'll continue this conversation. You're listening to Here and Now. What do you get when you combine robots, mad scientists, bad movies, and throw in some witty sarcasm? Well, of course, it's Mystery Science Theater 3000, or MST3K, as loyal fans, the Misties, call it. MST3K was a low-budget TV show that ran from 1988 to 99. Its unwitting hero, Joel, who was trapped in outer space, forced to sit through horrible B-movies, along with his smart-aleck robot companions, Crow and Tom Servo. They survived by mocking the films. Here's their take on a scene from the 1960 classic Hercules Unchained, when Hercules has lost his memory.
That's the second time you knocked over my goblet.
How would he remember that?
I do it for you, Hercules.
Why is it you keep on calling me Hercules?
You know my name is Todd.
Despite earning critics' praise, MST3K was eventually canceled. But now, members of the old guard have embarked on a new project called Cinematic Titanic. Here now is Karen Pelland, caught up with the gang at a recent sold-out performance on stage at the Somerville Theater here in Somerville, Massachusetts.
The man who rounded us all up for this, the man who decided that movies are best mocked by puppets and robots. The man we all love, and I sure do. Please welcome Joel Hodgson!
At the age of 49, Joel Hodgson still carries the boyish charm and easygoing manner he embodied as star and creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000. The show debuted on a local Minneapolis TV station and quickly found a national cable audience, but Joel left after just 4.5 seasons. Fittingly, he's now the idea man behind Cinematic Titanic, a series of DVDs and live stage shows that reunite some of the real people behind MST3K.
Yeah, it's us being ourselves. It's kind of the people who were dressed up in the outrageous costumes and shaking those puppets. And it's just much more direct because we're really just presenting a live concert of riffing.
Going to LA?
Okay, hop in.
And the winner of the 1972 Miss Careless Naive Motorist pageant.
This is how people get laws named after them.
We're all stand-up comics, and so to actually get back to a situation where there's a laugh attached to the joke that you're telling is really like crack for us.
That's Josh Weinstein. He was just 17 years old when Joel asked him to shake a puppet as the handler and voice of robot Tom Servo. The other robot, Crow T. Robot, was voiced by Trace Beaulieu, who also played Dr. Clayton Forrester, the dorky mad scientist who blasted Joel into space and made him watch all those terrible movies.
Well, you know, people think that we don't like these movies, that we're attacking them, but I think we all have a great affection for these films.
Yeah.
Having watched a lot of them when I was a kid in Creature Feature.
Before the show, I sat down with the cast of Cinematic Titanic, which also includes fellow MST alum Frank Conniff, who played Frank, the bumbling and lovable mad scientist sidekick, and Mary Jo Peel, who played the evil Pearl Forrester. Part of the appeal of Mystery Science Theater was that it was undeniably a labor of love. With an initial budget of just $35,000 per episode, certain details, like building the set, required a special kind of team spirit.
People who didn't really like to do construction were forced to do construction, like Josh and Frank.
Oh.
Were both required to like buy lumber, and I think Josh stapled Christmas lights to a wall.
He made the star field that's behind the spaghetti ball. That's Josh's handiwork.
How did you do that?
I stapled lights to a wall and
but
put
angrily.
Some velveteen.
Yeah. There was a lot of anger.
There was anger, and I think that came through in the stars. I think they twinkled a little brighter because they were fueled by anger.
We had kind of a Lord of the Flies sensibility to the show at certain times, and it had its own tyranny, and it was kind of Midwest-based, being able to sling a hammer, and things that are ridiculous in the world of television. You usually have professionals that do that.
I grew up in Manhattan, so the closest thing to any kind of power tool in our apartment was my father's martini shaker, you know.
Mystery Science Theater classics include such titles as Attack of the Giant Leeches and The Saga of the Viking Women and Their Voyage to the Waters of the Great Sea Serpent. But the cast agrees the worst movie they ever featured was Manos, The Hands of Fate. Here's the MST3K take on a scene in which a bunch of women wearing ultra-sheer togas are clumsily brawling with each other.
Next on ESPN, Full Contact Nightgown Wrestling.
And now the Manos Women's Guild will reenact the Battle of Pearl Harbor.
You know, this was the alternate ending to Beaches.
I'm guessing this is the whole reason this movie was made.
Right here.
I think there's kind of a misconception that we look at these movies and choose them because we feel like they deserve punishment. You know, we're trying to create sort of a new art form out of found pieces. So a huge percentage of what we do isn't talking about how bad the movie is, you know.
But also, a monster suit with a zipper up the back is very helpful to what
yes.
we do.
Yes.
For Mystery Science Theater, the cast stuck to a tight script, lobbing 500 to 600 jokes per movie at the screen. But Joel says the live cinematic Titanic shows demand improvisation.
With Mystery Science Theater, it was just us and the movie, and now there's this third element that comes into it. We're kind of sandwiched between the movie and the people.
Right.
And so we're working in both directions. We're constantly editing. Trace could have a joke that kills, and they're laughing so hard that it eclipses the setup for my joke. And it's never bothered me to have to...
You brought it up.
Well, yeah. Maybe there's something that's bugging me. But seriously, you don't mind because it's, wait a minute, we're getting a huge laugh.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'll just put one away.
It's an orchestra of voices, and it's so fun when, you know, it goes around the horn and everybody gets a huge, huge laugh. It's like, those are our laughs.
The Boston performance of Cinematic Titanic featured a rare early 70s-era blaxploitation-slash-kung-fu masterpiece called The Dynamite Brothers. In this scene, the heroes of both genres are on the run from something and handcuffed to each other.
Coming up on Dynamite Brothers, will Larry and Stud make it to the bottom of the hill before the camera runs out of film?
Okay, you convinced me. I'll vote no on Proposition 8.
On March 19th, Cinematic Titanic releases its 7th studio DVD, Blood of the Vampires. And as for the tour, well, there's no end in sight. But one thing is clear, the life force behind this reincarnation is not Joel, Josh, Trace, Frank, or Mary Jo, but the fans, the Misties.
It was so cool just to see the original cast. It was a little different without the puppets, but I kind of liked it better because you could just see like them reacting with one another, and then just seeing the entire cast is just amazing.
I thought it was really great. It had a really good energy. It was like seeing Mystery Science Theater with a whole bunch of friends, except magnified.
I have to admit, I didn't get my hopes up. I was trying to kind of keep on the low, and no, that didn't happen. I walked in, and they came on the stage, and oh, it was the voices. That's Crow. That's Stevie Frank. And that was out the window. I'm so starstruck.
For more on Cinematic Titanic and the Mystery Science Theater, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Our story was produced by Here and Now's Karen Pelland. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.